My name's Cynthia Wilson, and this message is for you. This podcast covers micro motivators to encourage you to act because small actions can make a big difference in your life. Welcome to episode 28. Today's message is take care of yourself. There are so many ways that you can apply this, but today I have brought my dear friend, Susanna Compositor, who is an end-of-life doula and Reiki master under multiple lineages, to talk with us about end-of-life care and how family who are caregivers can navigate this time. Welcome, Susanna.
Hi, Cynthia. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm so happy that you could be here with me today.
Yeah, I'm happy too. I'm happy to share this information too. So,
yeah, great. So let's just start off with like a little definition. So what's the difference between palliative care and hospice?
Well, technically, the only difference is when they're both available. Palliative care is available anytime after a diagnosis and can coexist with chemotherapy, such as with a cancer patient. You can maintain your treatment plans, but also find ways to make life more comfortable and manage symptoms, building a community of support, similar to hospice, but hospice, you have to have a diagnosis of 6 months or less to live. And so they really are the same thing, but once you're on hospice, you're not seeking any other treatments. You've stopped treatments and medications. It's just the next step after palliative care.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So what drew you to the end of life doula work or hospice work?
Okay. Well, first of all, it evolved into this as my life evolved. I've always been a caregiver. I started in my church when I was 9, taking care of babies, and it's never stopped. And I take care of whoever needs help, which has been from the beginning all the way through the end. And I was taking care of a newborn. And then his mom said, "Thank you for your help. I feel ready to do this by myself." And he was about 3 months old. And they said, "But would you take care of his great grandmother?" And I loved this family, and I'd been with them for a long time. And I said, "Well, of course." And I didn't think twice. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was walking into. But I said, "Well, of course, I'll take care of her." And she had a private room at a high-end nursing home. She had tons of care. She was 95, and she wanted to go. So I went in, and I was with her for a couple of months. And it was my first experience with end-of-life professionally. I had plenty personally, but I think it was just intuitive. I just took care of her. And then one day she just looked at me and said, "It's time." And I said, "What would you like to do?" And she said, "I'd like to go get in bed and see my grandson." So I called her grandson, who brought his son, who was the baby I used to take care of. And they came, and they said it was beautiful and peaceful, and I had nurses and doctors and caregivers and coming to me saying that was incredible. And I was a babe in the woods, had no idea what it was supposed to look like. And then I just started in my community, people calling me for end-of-life care. And I was a certified birthing postpartum doula, and I will have to admit that calling me a death doula did not sit with me. So I like the end-of-life doula or end-of-life private care.
What does a typical day look like for you?
There is no such thing. A typical day is starting my day with my self-care. Because if I connect with source in the morning, then I can handle whatever comes. And every day is different. Even if you've been with the same person, I've been with a woman now for, it's our 1 year anniversary coming up, and they called me in for end of life last year. And I always find it kind of ironic when people say this person's going home to pass and they're not. But I know I'm there for a reason, and I've been with her for a year, and it's very important to develop a self-care program that can evolve with you. And it can travel with you. So I get up and I do my meditation and I call in my source and now I do my Qigong, or I do some somatic yoga that I learned from Stacy. And I really center myself, and I just have so much gratitude knowing that I have that support, because it's really a go with the flow, take it as it comes. There's no typical thing. Everything's unexpected.
So, what are the most common misconceptions that families have around hospice care?
Think the first misconception is that when a hospital says that someone's going home on hospice, family members hear, their loved one is being discharged from the hospital and going home on hospice. Immediately they think that's it and they're going home to pass. And it's a misconception because, first of all, they're not going home on hospice. Nobody's meeting him at the door. Nobody's waiting at their house. If they fell a few weeks back or however long it's been, that mess is still there. So I think family members, it usually starts with a fall. That's the most common way people start on hospice. They just can't come back from a fall. So the family members have not always been involved in their lives in a daily way until something like that happens and the doctors say there's nothing more we can do. They're going home on hospice, and immediately the family thinks they're going home to die. All that means is that the hospital and the doctors can't do anything for you at that time. And there's still so much that can be done. It just can't be done at the hospital. So people think, I think that's the biggest misconception. When people hear the word hospice, they think they're dying right now. And that's the hardest thing to help people understand.
Are there other misconceptions?
That we can tell them when their loved one's going to pass. That's I feel very very strong about. We're all going to be in the same place at some point, right? Unless we have found something to become immortal. And I think the hardest part for families is realizing the mortality and realizing that they've gone on with their lives and had their families and their careers, and their parents are doing great, or their, whoever their loved one is. And then something happens and they realize that everything becomes real. And you think, I'm doing all of these things and I haven't been home. And I thought they confront their own mortality. And it kind of brings you back to the moment. And for me, it's been such a blessing because it helps me stay centered and focused on now, in the moment. And helping others process not feeling the guilt and not feeling like, you're supposed to grow up and leave home and you're supposed to go have your own life. And, if you're lucky enough to have somebody who will come home, but a lot of times people hire private care because they have lives in different parts of the country or different parts of the world. And I try to help them release that feeling of obligation. It's like, that's why we're here. But I think it's a misconception that there's so many psychological things that come up for people. And then, like I said, everybody's different. There's the misconceptions come from what they were previously, their experience has been, and what they've been exposed to. So it's different with everyone. Those are the two main ones I can think of for everyone.
Awesome. Thanks. What are the best ways to organize medications and care routines that you have come up with or seen?
So the first things I do when I come into a family or come into any home is create an organizational system for meals, medications, for personal care. I'm setting up stations so that it's easy to manage. There's pill boxes. And do we want person to have access to these pills, do it themselves, or do they need a caregiver to do it for them? And if so, get the right pill box, that kind of thing. Making sure they have personal care items that they can use. If you're trying to keep them as independent as possible, as long as possible. And so we set up pill boxes and personal care stations, meal plans, meal deliveries. It's really about organization from top to bottom. What clothing they're going to wear. Can they wear the same clothing that they wore before whatever the event was? And making sure that they have what they're comfortable in and what they can put on for themselves, not need assistance if that's the case. Making sure that household furniture, rugs, making sure everything is safe. And making changes, which is a really hard step. That's your first step. It's assessing, what needs to happen for them to be safe in their homes. Because our goal as private caregivers, obviously, is to keep people in their homes as long as possible, and to involve friends and family and process their lives and things. So, in order to stay in your home at all, you have to address the safety concerns, organizational things, and make sure that they have access to the basics. So that's what we do in the first 24 to 48 hours.
That's great. That sounds like a huge help to all these families that are just kind of still processing probably what is happening and how they're dealing with it and how everything's going to work.
And Cynthia, it's sometimes that's the only part I play. And it took a long time for me to get used to that, but once that piece is in place, it takes the stress off the family. They feel more confident. They feel like now they don't have to worry about things they didn't have any idea to think about. And you put those things in place, it makes it easier for the family members to care for their loved ones. I mean, if the goal is to keep them as primary caregiver, those things are the most important. How do you get in and out of the house? Do you have the right equipment? So sometimes that's all I do is I go in for a 48-hour assessment and get that all set up. It's a
That
crucial
makes sense.
piece. Yeah. So.
What are the most helpful things that a caregiver can do during the final days?
Be calm. Be present. Be available. Be flexible. I think that that comes to me first because things could be going along a certain way. And then when that moment comes, things could shift. If a family member decides, nope, I've been doing it up till now, but I can't do this, you have to be ready to smoothly give them permission to walk away and say, that's okay. You're an extension of them. You're not replacing them. You're an extension of them. And I've had a lot of clients where I've taken care of the children of my client and the family and the friends, making food, making tea, whatever it is, giving them a break, because that's really what it's about. It's not about, needing to be the one. And I even got to some points that I wasn't there when my client actually passed. If you empower the family and the family feels like this is what we want, then I had to respect that. And they know I'm on speed dial and I get the 2 o'clock in the morning calls, like, I changed my mind. And I'm good with that. It's really just about whatever they need and knowing when to step back and how to be very available. And it's very fluid. It's very much go with the flow.
So, how can caregivers prepare for the physical changes they may witness?
So, the physical changes, I wish I had the book right here with me. It's called Gone from Sight. And hospice gives them out to families when they bring them on to hospice. they don't go through it a lot with the family. So it's kind of a lot of information, and you can get them on Amazon if you look up, any kind of hospice books. You can get pamphlets, and they're short and sweet, but they list what happens maybe months before passing, and then weeks before passing, and then hours or days, and then they go down to minutes. But it's good to have this information because you're on the lookout for things. The double-edged sword is that you don't want to worry every time you see anything. Oh, they grimaced. Oh, geez, that must mean it's today. And that's unsettling because it's also taking away from the present moment. So it's good to have that information. It's very specific what happens as the body shuts down. But even the booklet is there's so many variables. I've had people pass in my arms transferring to a commode instead of, and they weren't expected, quote unquote, they weren't expected to go that day. But we've all struggled with loss, and loss can happen at any time. There are things that, when they come out of the hospital and that they're just not going to make it. They have very specific things that happens to the body when it shuts down. I can elaborate on that, but it's a little intense. I think it's the hardest part for families to deal with is understanding. And I'll just put this out there that to me, through my experience and what I've learned through this whole last decade plus has been there's a spiritual component and a human component, and I believe that we're souls having a human experience. And a lot of, Ram Dass channeled Emmanuel and wrote. It's just an incredible book that has been beside me for decades. And he said, what is death like? And Emmanuel said, it's like taking off a tight pair of shoes. And I've seen a lot of things in the work I've done where I could feel the soul, the essence of the person in the room. And I've seen things that you can't unsee. There's been times where the body's going through the physical trying to shut down, but the soul is in the room. And it's very comforting as a caregiver once you've seen this because you can care for the physical being and remove the physical pain resistance. And when the soul's ready to go, it will go. But it's comforting to know that they're not in pain, that they're not struggling to leave that body. But it's a very, very, it's a scientific thing. I mean, the soul is leaving the body, they're separating. And it's your job to help them do that and to remove the physical pain resistance. I'm going to add something here because one of the biggest misconceptions, obviously, is that morphine is going to kill their loved one. That's a big deal. It's morphine. I have given to people, I actually took morphine after a car accident that I had. And all it did was relieve all the pain. And I thought the angels were singing and I was finally out of pain. And I felt wonderful. I've given it to patients, my clients, for breathing, for pain, just in general, the Ativan for relaxation. And they say, oh, this had a bad rap. I wish I was taking this a long time ago. And they get up and they want to take a shower and have dinner and go to the office because it helps them breathe and it alleviates the pain. And sometimes just being with somebody, gets rid of their depression because they're lonely. But one of the biggest misconceptions is that the medications would kill them because you can take a whole bottle of that morphine. And if it's not your time to go, you're not going. So I that's one of the biggest misconceptions. And I think that caregivers have a difficult time as well because the family doesn't want to be the one to give them that shot. And it's a medicine dropper with a very tiny amount of medication, but significant enough to help their bodies not have pain while shutting down. And I think that's the biggest misconception about the process that I would like people to understand is that that's a gift that you can give them to relieve that pain.
For patients who may not have been super coherent, do you see moments of lucidity before the passing?
Well, this is where you get into the whole spiritual stuff, because I've taken care of people who are atheists, strict Catholic, Buddhists, I mean, you name it, I mean, everything and anything. The one common thing is that at the time of passing, 99.9% of the time, they see a light, they see a loved one. When they're leaving their body, it's like we're preparing them for a journey, and we are their ground crew, and we get them comfortable, and we get them, seat backs upright, tray tables stored, a little bit, and you stow your things under the seat. And I was a flight attendant for a while too, so we like to use that analogy. But I live on the water, so we use the ship, loading onto the ship, and then it sails off. And it goes over the horizon and you can't see it anymore. That doesn't mean they're gone. It means they're going to be landing somewhere else and they're going to have a crew to meet them. So once you start to visualize it that way and you see signs that your loved one is still with you, it makes it easier. Even the person passing is when they start seeing loved ones come through, they're like, oh, yeah, I'm okay. I'm gonna go. And no matter what your religious beliefs are or what your cultural upbringings are, the spirituality kind of comes in at the end for everyone because it's right there. And it's a blessing.
Yeah. So there's been experiences with both my parents who have passed before my dad passed, and I was there for his passing, right? He raised his arms to the sky. And I was not in the room when he did that, but three of my siblings were. And I swear he waited for me to be in that room.
Sure.
I felt it was beautiful and I felt it was an honor to be there.
Absolutely.
And yeah, so I look at that positively. And for my mom, she had just come home from a rehab and had a heart attack after coming home from rehab when she was dismissed. So
Oh
we
my
had all of her
goodness.
stuff, which was a blessing, right? We didn't have to
Oh
deal with the
gosh.
rehab center anymore.
Oh no.
But, and my mom was blind at the end of her life. She had a degenerative disease, but she said, "Where are you taking me?" So we know she saw someone.
Wow.
And we, felt
It's
that
amazing.
it was my dad, maybe because that was the
Sure.
first time back in the house.
Sure.
But funny enough, I went to a medium and he shared that it was actually my uncle, which I found really interesting because my uncle was like a radio operator during the war, and he would try to get people to communicate with each other. So it felt very apropos
It's
in that
ironic.
respect.
Yeah. It's interesting to see who comes through at the time of passings. I've also had people not want to pass because they've seen somebody come into the room and you can tell by their face that they didn't like who they saw. So we have those conversations. We have the awkward conversations that the family members are like, I don't really want to be part of this, but I'll see. Hey, who is it that you don't want to see? And I had one gentleman who said, my brother, he's coming through and I'm not going. And I said, well, talk to me about that. And they had some fallings out and they had some, and sometimes those are the ones that will come forward first because they want forgiveness and they want to greet you and show you that on the other side, that doesn't exist. Because they've been over there and they know that once you're there, none of that exists. So sometimes the one you have the most problems with, or the one that was most difficult to get along with, sometimes will come through first. And people are like, I'm not going with them. And I said, well, you don't have to, but let's deal with that emotion. And then trying to help them understand that it's about forgiveness and about love and we don't bring all this baggage over there. It's just still being in the same realm, but out of body. So it's the essence of who you are. And I said, that's nothing but love. I've seen some things where people really are like just not going. And we do ask that they send somebody else. Gentleman expected his wife and he got his brother and he was very upset. So there's a lot of that going on. I had a woman on hospice for 8 years and she said she was not going anywhere, that she was going to be the last one standing. And her husband passed and she was waiting for her son to pass. And she said, I'm just not going. And she said, I have money and I live on the water and I'm not. So it's funny at the end of life, how much free will has to do with it. And some people will just hang on beyond all expectations or rationalizations, or you can't even figure out how this is happening. And then some people pass and you think, that didn't make sense either because they were doing better. So I think our souls have a purpose. And our souls have a contract, and they know when it's time, and they'll just go. And we try to make it as peaceful as possible, but some just go, I'm out. And none of this happens. So sometimes that's a gift instead of the family having to really deal with the dynamics that they grew up with, or difficult relationships, or things like that. That's kind of the worst part of it.
How do you handle family disagreements about care decisions?
That's so funny that you just asked that because that's what I was thinking of when I stopped myself because, I went down that rabbit hole. I think that when somebody is passing or has a diagnosis of it's not going to be very long, it could be anywhere from now to 6 months, which is just the criteria for hospice. And then every 6 months, they either renew it or they take you off of it. So that does not mean that you're passing right away. But what that does is it triggers people into emotions, stored resentments. And the daughter that always felt like the other sibling was more important or never felt seen and never felt heard and all of a sudden wants to be the one to care for their parent. And then the other one thinks that they're better with money and business and stuff. So they come in and somebody else is a nurse and they say, well, I'm better at all of it because I'm a nurse. And it's just it's sad. That's one extreme. A lot of family baggage comes out at that time, which is why I dealt with a lot of mine already, because I don't want that to happen. But I also see the best side of it too, with families that have not gotten along and families that have had so much discourse. All of a sudden, they're, together and they're, they've come from wherever their homes are and they're taking care of each other. And they're, one of them is using their strengths to organize the finances, or the other one is, organizing the family chain and how to notify people. But I think that what happens at the time of thinking somebody's passing right then is that it's not just about them. It's about everybody else realizing that this is it. This is the last moment. So everything comes up, good, bad, indifferent, whatever it is. And I can't get in the middle of it because it's not my journey. That's not my place. I can take care of their parent usually while they're handling their things. But there actually have been clients I've had to say, I can't be in the middle of this situation. And in that case, what I do is I call hospice. We're all on speed dial for each other. And I'll call the social worker and I'll say, you really need to get out there. Or I'll call the head nurse and say, we really need some support over there. And then sometimes they say, yeah, that's been going on for a long time and we've already tried and it's not our place to do that. If it gets to the point of any kind of elder abuse or not giving proper medications, then we would call Adult Protective Services to have that client well cared for. If there's financial issues of money being stolen or people trying to get them to sign wills and things like that, which happens unfortunately too much, then we would call the police and just say, sometimes adult protective services is enough. But it's our job to also protect them from any abuse, whether it's a family member or not. Anybody taking advantage of them financially or otherwise, it's our job to notify people and to make sure somebody's eyes are on it. But it's not usually our position as a private caregiver, even though we'd like to sometimes. It's not ethically okay for us to get involved with the family squabbles and the financial parts of things, but it happens more often than you'd like. It's difficult to see.
So, how can caregivers support their loved ones' spiritual needs, even if they don't share the same beliefs?
That's a really hard one. It's interesting because it's when kids grow up and go and move away and have their own families. They sometimes will go off on their own religious journeys or spiritual journeys that they don't share with their parents. The funny thing is, and I just took care of a woman for a friend of mine. She used to run an agency for home care. And her mom, after the kids all moved away, got into going to retreats and going into yoga and doing meditations. And she did tarot and she did all of these amazing things. And her daughter had no idea. And when she started, she had a little dementia, but she could still have a complete conversation with you, just depending on what you were trying to talk about. When I go in with somebody with dementia and Alzheimer's and things, you relate to them on an energetic level. You follow their lead. If they remember one thing and they, even if it's not real, doesn't matter. You can still engage with them and have a conversation. We're in an age right now where people are more expansive and becoming more aware. So it's not, sometimes the kids will find that their parent has found this. Oh, Dalai Lama was the best thing ever. And Deepak this. And they go, and the kids are like, you raised a strict Catholic. And they're still dealing with their religious upbringings. And they are unable to really see anything different because they're at a different place in their lives. They're 40s and 50s. And either they've come to that place on their own or they haven't. But you can't usually cross that. It doesn't usually mesh well. So they, especially if they have private care, I think sometimes that's one of the main reasons they do, because they are not able to help them where they are. Either the kids have gotten really spiritual and gone off on that, and the parents are stuck in, this is my religious belief, and this is what's going to happen to me when I die. And it's not always a pleasant thought. So you help them kind of, shapeshift that into a different feeling so they can accept it and feel peaceful. And I find that most of the kids can't, they're kids, they're grown adults, but they're unable to mesh regardless of who's on which side. At that point, spirituality and religion is too big of a concept for them to deal with at the time of losing a loved one, in my opinion. In my opinion.
What signs suggest that a loved one is in pain, even if they can't speak?
The first thing is grimacing. You can see the visible in their face. Moaning. They can moan even if they're non-responsive. Change in the breathing. Breathing gets more audible. Sometimes their bodies get tense. If you're nearby them, sometimes they'll grab your hand or you squeeze. And those are the primary things that we look for. The primary things for pain is that it is pretty obvious. The grimacing and the breathing changes are the two most prevalent Red flags.
In some cases where you may not be exactly kind of at end of life and there's still hope to prolong, how would you help caregivers navigate decisions about resuscitation and life prolonging measures?
That's one of the first questions that we go over when I do an assessment with a client and their families, especially. But sometimes, like the client I'm with now, there's no family. She has some family, but they're in Texas, and her brother is older than she is, and she's 89. So when there's no other family around, you make sure that there's either an attorney that has their power of attorney. And if it's not already in place, it's something you have to get in place because you don't want that on you either. And people will try to gift you their everything they have. And morally, we just don't do that. Ethically, it's not okay. So we always get an attorney on. But that is something that hospice, when hospice comes into your house, a lot of times, 99% of the time, in order to be on hospice, you have to sign a DNR, which is a do not resuscitate. Hospice won't force it. But in order for you, I think it's a good thing to have, whether it's palliative care or hospice care. I think for anyone to have living wills, to feel that they have a health agent, to feel that they have somebody who understands. We don't know what that situation is going to look like. My stepfather was on a ventilator for 4 months, and they said there was absolutely no way that he was still there. And he's still here today. So I think that there's powers greater than ourselves. And the DNR should be discussed right away. I have the client I'm with now, and many, many clients will not want to transport. So they'll sign a do not transport, meaning that you can call 911 for a lift assist or to move them into bed if they pass somewhere other than in their bed. But they cannot be transported. And the DNRs are always on the refrigerator. And that's their decision. And that doesn't mean that at the time, you can't make a decision to do something. I had my client fell and broke ribs. And this happens more often than not with breaking ribs. And there's not much you can do for that, but to transport them and check and see, because there might need to be medication changes. It doesn't mean that they have to change their DNR and they don't have to change their do not transport. But if you need to make sure their medications are still okay and there's no internal bleeding and you can still move them. So we'll do it for that. And they're very flexible with that. It's usually the client that decides, I'm ready to go. I've lost my loved one. I've been here for this long and my body's not 100%. I've had a good life. Some people joke about it. Some people are terrified of it. Some people say, can you get me something though that'll make this happen a little faster? And I say, no, that would ethically not be okay. But everybody's got their own idea. They just DNRs are very common. And usually right on the refrigerator when you walk in the door. So.
Yeah, I will say to people out there that it's really important that you know that your loved ones have a DNR. Some people may decide earlier in their lives that they don't want to live after such an event.
Yes.
And so have those conversations, even though
Absolutely.
they're tough,
Yeah.
because then you may be doing something against someone's will.
And I think, Cynthia, even everybody be having these conversations. It's not just, people talk about end of life as if it's just an elderly thing. It's not just an elderly thing. And I lost my cousin at 17. I've had a lot of losses. I'm sure many people have. Sometimes we don't have a choice. My stepdad had a surgery and developed sepsis and went into septic shock. and was on a ventilator for 4 months. And his daughter said he wouldn't want to live like this. And my mother said, as long as there's a chance that he's okay, I'm going to wait. And she's a registered nurse and retired now. So this is very common with my clients. And when you were talking about family members not agreeing, there's always going to be that. But there's a power of attorney and there's a health agent. And that's why there's one person that you trust to make that decision. And it's not a decision I would want to have to make in a situation like that. So I prefer that my clients just say, listen, if A, B, or C happens, I'm out. If anything happens, I'm out. Or do everything you possibly can to save my life. Because they usually have a very clear feeling about it. But that's another reason why we should be having these conversations at 30 and 40 and 50, and understanding that it's not just an elderly thing. And there's a sense of peace once you've had that conversation. And you value every moment, I think, a little bit more once you get to that place.
Definitely. So, what do you wish more families would say or ask during the end of lifetime?
I don't know if there's a big thing around that. I feel like I always tell the families, if there's any questions, and I make sure I have time with everyone who wants to be available for that. And everybody has comes from a different place. Ask whatever you want, say whatever you need to. And boy, they do. And that's okay. That's a good thing. The variety you can have within one family is incredible. Some people come at it with humor. Some people are devastated. Some people are, really okay with this whole process and want to be part of it. And somebody wants to run for food because that's how they can cope. The dynamics are so different, and I'm fine with all of them. I want people to be able to say, I can't do this. Or I choose not to do this. I don't want to remember my mom or my dad or my loved one like this. I can't say goodbye yet. Or, and they feel an obligation as their child or their loved one that they have to be the one. And a lot of times when people are passing, they won't pass with you in the room. That's why it was such an honor for you to have that, because you allowed them to be free. And a lot of times people won't leave if they don't think their loved ones are going to be okay. So, usually they wait for everybody to leave anyways, and then they'll kind of slip out real fast, because it's just too hard. And I wish people, I can't say I wish people, because I think every caregiver who really is compassionate, empathetic, and that's what brings us to do what we do, understands how difficult this is, and it opens that door and says, anything that you need to know or that you want to know, anything I can help you with, nothing's off limits in that zone. So I think that's I cover that personally right off the bat.
What are some common emotional reactions that caregivers experience, and how can they be supported?
Oh, that's a huge one, but it's never my job to support them during someone's passing. If somebody's having a difficult time, I assure them it's okay for them to step out and definitely connect with them later and definitely work with them later and help them process later. But it is not the time or place. And I think it's something to think about. I mean, obviously, if it's not your family member and you're choosing this as a profession, you need to contemplate a lot of things and you need to do a lot of self-work, because you will see things that will trigger you, and you can't put yourself first. When I go into a client, I clear and I allow source to work through me. It's not about me. It's a very sacred time. I just calmly say, I'm sorry that this is difficult for you, but why don't you go home and I'll call you tomorrow, or I'll connect with you soon, and because it's just not appropriate. I've seen euphoria in anxiety, just people say the weirdest things, and the family just goes, now you've shifted the whole dynamic. So going into this, I'm actually very careful who I work with. And we have a handful of people that we trust and that we vibe with and that we know that we don't have any surprises like that. And we don't just say, hey, come on in. You can do end of life. It's a very sacred time, and it's a time to respect the boundaries and the family, and you don't know where everybody's coming from, and there's no room for the caregivers to bring their things in. You're holding space for the family, you're holding space for the person passing. And if I felt like I couldn't keep my personal feelings out of it, then I would remove myself from the situation. Because it's just too sacred. If it's prior to passing and you have an opportunity to work through these things, then I would do it outside of the family home. It's not the family's responsibility to add your stuff to it. I think we're brought to it for a reason, for the triggers and the blessings and the lessons and the whole bit, but it's not appropriate to take care of it at work. Just like nobody else would take care of their personal things at their jobs. Yeah.
Sorry. So I'm one of eight, right? My dad came home on hospice, yet we still decided to have private caregivers help us out. And I wanted to share that because I think it's really important. So even if you have a lot of people,
Absolutely.
it is important for everybody to be able to have a break. So we're not just
Absolutely.
doing rounds and figuring out shifts of people, and there's different skills that are needed for certain things because,
Yes.
can you lift a person if needed in a way to clean them after a bowel movement, or who's feeling comfortable with medications and giving them? Not
Sure.
everybody will feel that way.
Right.
So, it's important to think about these things and where everybody's comfort level is in that process.
I'm really glad that you brought that up, Cynthia, because the first thing I do is I give everyone permission. And it's funny how many people are just waiting for permission. And even the person passing is just waiting for people to say it's okay to go. We're always waiting for approval and for permission and are we doing the right thing and are we doing it correctly? And I always tell people that, this is your journey too. And if you're feeling aligned and called to it, that doesn't mean you can't change your mind at the last minute. You don't even have to start the process. Taking care of a loved one's one thing, helping them transition is another. And wouldn't it be nice if you could just be there as their daughter or their son or their wife or their husband? That's why private caregivers are there for you, because we can take care of all the other moving pieces. And you just get to be present as the person you are in their lives. And those are precious, precious moments. And you don't want to be worrying about emptying a bedpan or changing a brief or, heating up a cup of tea or whatever it is. That's why a private caregiver will help you do those things so that you can just sit bedside and pray or laugh or whatever it is and be there as their loved one. I think that's very crucial. And you have a village to really support you in this journey. Allow that. Allow that. There's nothing to prove. So that's
Everybody
huge.
needs a break sometime, and everyone needs to take care of themselves.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, because it really doesn't matter how many siblings you have either. There's one person that ends up carrying the load, or then you just have more chance for more squabbles. It's just good to have a buffer in there.
Yep. So, what is the most beautiful goodbye that you've witnessed?
I think they're all beautiful in their own way. I've had some that were kind of traumatic on the human end, but I think they're all beautiful. My favorite part is the signs that come after, because I really do believe and I feel them and I see them, and my prayer is always that they will show their family a sign that they've gotten there safely and that they're with them. And we joke about it as, now you can haunt all of them at the same time, things like that. And so I feel like they're all beautiful. Some obviously are more comfortable than others, but I've only had one that was traumatic for me, not for them. They had already removed themselves from the body, but I think passing is so beautiful because it reaffirms and validates to me that we're part of something so much bigger, and really value the time we have here and the lessons that we came here to learn and the lives that we can touch and the difference that we can make in people's journeys. So I think they're all really beautiful.
So we met, you mentioned a little bit about the signs after death. What should caregivers expect in the hours and days after passing?
So, other than seeing signs, there's nothing after. I always tell families right away, and I tell the other caregivers if that situation arises, there's no emergency. Nothing is urgent. It's a time for breathing. It's a time for pausing. It's a time for reflecting. Sometimes we will wait because somebody's flight hasn't arrived and somebody wants to get there. And the very, very end, sometimes we'll do FaceTime calls because people are in transit and can't get there. So I'll say, here's my phone. And we do a FaceTime so that they can actually say goodbye to them. So right after someone passes physically, make sure that they are sitting up if possible, with the head of the bed raised as flat as they can, because the blood will pool, especially on their face, and their bodies do get cold and they do get stiff. So placing them in a laying down position as you would, if they have, everybody has their own thoughts on this, but open casket funerals, if the body gets too stiff, you can't move the body. Sometimes after somebody passes, what we do as caregivers is it's a very sacred thing, depending, it doesn't really depend on who they were religiously. When somebody passes, we clean their bodies very respectfully. We'll dress them in whatever the family has asked us to dress them in. And you really have a short window to do that. And depending on the size of the person, depending on the situation that we're in, sometimes we need an extra person. So we will all do it for each other, show up and say, somebody just passed and I need you here for an hour, and help wash the body, and say prayers depending on what their religious belief was. You can find prayers. The internet is wonderful for that. We usually will kind of get that set up beforehand. But as far as the family goes, when somebody passes, there's no emergency. There's no urgency. Some people want to sit, with their mom or their dad and say the things they wanted to say before they come. Usually we call the funeral home and notify them. And as caregivers, we do that if the family can't, obviously, if whatever the family wants to do is on them. But we'll always step in. And I work with the f local funeral home and I know him, so he knows what's happening. And they will come and wait if you want to wait. Or I can just say they want to wait a few hours, so don't come right away. Some people are like, I'm done. That's it. Have them waiting outside the door. So it's different every time, but after somebody passes, you can make it anything you need it to be as a family. Physically, the body just, their soul's not there. So it's usually the final goodbyes for family if they want to sit with them for a little while. But yeah, it's usually the signs that follow when they see the butterfly or the 200-year-old tractor that's sitting out in the middle of the field that just started, which I did have happen after a client passed. I said, I said, they really need to see a sign after you pass. You have to show them a sign. His wife was still with us and all his kids were grown. They were all there and they had a kind of a family compound. And he said, oh, I'll show them all right. And I said, oh, you will you? And he laughed and he said, yep. And they actually did a shot of whiskey with him before he passed. And I put the whiskey in the medicine dropper and just put a little bit in each cheek. And the family was so happy. And he passed like right after that. He probably thought they were going to just keep going if he didn't. But the next morning, a 200-year-old tractor that was sitting out in the middle of the field as a decoration started. And they all looked at me and said, okay. Because after a person passes, we help with getting all the medical equipment out of the house, cleaning, obviously. Once the funeral home has come and taken the body, then we clean the house. We get all the medical equipment out of the house if possible. We notify hospice. We empty all medications so that there's no medications left in the house. We make sure that there's supports in place for the family members. Sometimes they want us to stay for a night, which is very common. And making sure that we contact hospice and we make sure that call the funeral home. So just those kind of things. But like I said, it just varies. It varies with everyone.
How do you support caregivers in transitioning from doing to grieving?
Caregivers. So I guess that depends if it's a family member or if it's a caregiver, like a private caregiver. Private caregivers, I always encourage different kinds of healing, whatever kind of healing, whether you're going to go for a Reiki session or a sound bath or go see your therapist, or we can go take a walk and talk about things. So there's that processing because caregivers process every time. And we usually get together for a cup of coffee or something or a walk and process what happened and how we felt and what we learned and that kind of thing. And as far as the family goes, just making yourself available as hospices do as well. They have a 1 year bereavement. The chaplain will come, the social worker. There's just a lot of support out there in the community. You don't have to keep a private caregiver on. Per se, I do a lot of things like making the clothing donations and cleaning out homes, and it's hard for kids to do, but then sometimes it turns into a party because they're like, oh, I remember this from when I was five, or I broke the pair to this, and they can tell stories. And sometimes families, it's the most healing thing they can do after a parent passes. It's just to be in their homes and go through their things and reminisce and distribute things. And I think that's it's a very powerful time, reconciliation between siblings, sometimes. And also it just gives everybody a lot of closure. So it's a good part of the process.
So, what tips would you give to family members navigating end of life for a loved one? So, as we wrap up here.
The first thing I always recommend caregivers and families is to contact, well, your primary care doctor, because in order to get hospice, you need an order from your primary care doctor. So whatever your situation is, your primary care doctor would be able to tell you if you qualified for palliative or hospice. And I'm going to say palliative care is available no matter what. You might not get admitted through a hospice for palliative care, but palliative care is just a lot of supports that your primary doctor can provide you. So start it with the primary care, reach out to a local hospice, connect with them, connect with the social worker. They have private caregiver lists at the hospital and at the hospices, and start interviewing people and start, even if you never use them, just interview some private caregivers, have some backup. Some I never see again, and some call me every single day. Some we're still friends to this day. It's a very, very significant process point in our lives. So reach out to your primary care, your hospices, and interview private caregivers. Talk to your friends if they know people. Get somebody on tap.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been amazing talking with you, Susanna.
Well, Cynthia, I can't thank you enough. It lights me up to talk about it, and it lights me up to share. And I want everybody to feel like, because we're all going to be dealing with this, and I just want everybody to feel loved and supported. So I really thank you for putting all this out there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. So, everyone, please take care of yourself and remember, this message is for you.